Back with you, a busy show on Monday, August 10th on Connecticut Today. We watched the power numbers dwindle as far as people in the dark as crews from UI and Eversource got people back online in the wake of Tropical Storm Isaias. What about the people that lost power for several days or maybe even a week? What was the psychological impact they may have felt? We discussed that with a professor from Quinnipiac University. We heard a portion of Governor Ned Lamont's 4 p.m. briefing on COVID-19 and the storm response. We welcomed a professor from Southern Connecticut State University on the federal response to the need for more money to states and federal unemployment insurance. And in the 5 o'clock hour, reporter Luther Termel from Hearst Connecticut Media joined us to talk about his years reporting on and covering Connecticut's major power utilities. Stressed out they are. I mean, think about it. You have the virus. You have a change in workplace. Oh, I have to go to the office. No, I got to stay home. I got to stay home half the day. Then I got to go to the office. I go to the office, but it's 100 degrees because nothing is working in there. When's the virus going to end? I don't have sports to just, you know, zone out to at night. Well, we're going to welcome back a guest we've had on before, psychology professor Carrie Bulger at Quinnipiac University. She studies industrial organizational psychology. What is this doing to the psyche of people, especially when they just thought being home and working from home was great? Well, it hasn't been for the past week. Carrie, hi. Good to hear from you again. How are you?
Hi. Great to be here, Paul. Thanks for having me back.
Man, are people's psyches getting beat up in this thing or what this year? I mean, you know, I forgot to mention the murder hornets. They're out there, too.
Right.
I know whether you saw over the weekend, we had a deadly case of the plague in New Mexico.
Yep.
That was frosting. Is this stuff, how bad could this stuff be, Professor, on somebody's psyche?
No, it is. You nailed it. It's cumulative stress, right? So we all have this sort of overlying kind of an umbrella of the virus, the pandemic, and not knowing what's coming or when it's going to end. And then you add to it a new way of working, or for some people not working at all, or having to work when you're being exposed potentially to people who have the virus. All those things are pretty significant sources of stress. And then you add last week's tropical storm on it, and people still today, last I heard it was 90,000 customers still without power in Connecticut.
Yeah, just
that
about,
may be
yeah.
better by now. Mm-hmm. But so now we have to figure out, okay, I'm working from home, except I don't have electricity or internet to get my stuff done. You're definitely seeing a larger amount of stress in folks than you would have been normally seeing in August. And people could go to the beach on the weekends and feel safe.
Yeah. And not have a care.
Right.
You know, Professor, I took a call from a woman. I did a Saturday show here, and it was a very nice woman. And she said, you know, I'm 90 years old. She said, up until the time I was 16, which was right after I did the math, it was, I think, right after the end of World War II. She said,
sure.
we didn't have electricity. She lived in a part of the valley here in Connecticut that didn't have electricity. And her point was, I've kind of been through this before, like I've seen or heard this before. And what we're going to now, she said in kind of an interesting way, she goes, this is taking me back to kind of my childhood here. So she said, I'm okay. That's interesting, isn't it, Carrie? Because here's something she experienced. And she said, okay, it's a little inconvenient, but this is how it was with me growing up. To other people, millions going, oh, my God, how does my life go on?
For sure. I think we see the same thing with folks who had, you know, hobbies or interests that weren't necessarily tied to technology, right? So jigsaw puzzles are sold out all over the world because people are now doing jigsaw puzzles like crazy, right? So I think if you had that interest before pandemic, you were okay. You had something you already knew you liked to do, right? And I think going forward, it speaks to needing to get back to that a little bit. How do we survive if we don't have electricity for a short period of time, relatively speaking? How do we do our jobs, our family lives, if we don't have technology available at the moment's notice?
A lot of people, Carrie, are angry, right? We see the articles. Well, we're going to get the power company. We're going to get UI. We're going to get CLNP, or I'm sorry, Eversource, and all the state legislators and congressional members. They're all breathing fire. But I think maybe they know, as some columnists have said, deep in their hearts, I mean, this is, you know, the kind of stuff that we kind of deal with up here, just the way people in Florida, you know, deal with hurricanes and twisters and flooding all the time. But I guess sometimes lashing out, dealing with the anger is just what we do, huh?
Well, for sure. I mean, if you think about people responding in heat waves, this is what we do. We get angry much more quickly. There's more violence during hot weather. But I think that that umbrella of stress that you were talking about, that I was talking about, that's there, right? So now we've got a target for our anxiety and our anger. Hey, and maybe we'll find that CLMP or Eversource and UI did wrong and raised rates and should have been working on putting wires underground a long time ago. But whether or not that's the case, I'm sure we're lashing out as a group more than we normally might.
You and I spoke several months ago when this whole coronavirus thing started, and we were chatting about the idea, I remember, of working from home and mm-hmm. not having that kind of camaraderie or the workplace or being able to just, you know, lean over to somebody in our office and say, hey, what do you make of this? I don't quite understand that. Then everybody started to say, well, we can work at home and still get it done. And now, Carrie, I'm reading that, well, maybe that was good for a couple of months, but maybe it's a better idea to deal with the drive, to deal with the cranky boss, and be in the workplace. So at this point, we really don't know what we want, do we?
I think not. I think we're all tired of not having that camaraderie, for sure. And then this week of no electricity, no access, has made more people feel like this isn't sustainable, right, working from home for long term. I think there's probably a meet in the middle, right, whereas you can work from home sometimes and not all the time, and it would potentially have a savings for employers and for employees. If I don't have to commute every day, that's going to be a savings for me. But I think I'd like something more in the middle where I could have the best of both worlds.
It's amazing that business was done, relationships forged, major decisions made, organizational trees and levels set up back 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago here in this country without the need for, you know, two smartphones, a tablet, a desktop constantly going off. I mean, if anything, Carrie, I think psychologically, a lot of this stuff has become our lifeboat. If we don't have it, we're almost flailing away.
Yeah, we definitely have to come up with backup systems. I mean, I love technology. I'm glad I'm able to collaborate with people all over the world and doing my research and talking about teaching and all that stuff. But at the same time, nothing like standing up in front of a whiteboard with a marker and writing stuff down for your students. And I think the same is true in the workplace, right? We got to have, you know, take a pencil and a piece of paper and map it out. And that's how you do your flowchart, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We need both.
What is the attitude that you've been hearing, Carrie, of you and your fellow faculty members at Quinnipiac and students? You know, we're going to try to start schooling a bit in the coming weeks in the midst of the pandemic thing here. We kind of finished up a frayed second semester or last half of the previous year. Now we're going to try this again. Give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a challenging transition. We're at Quinnipiac, we're planning to do what's called a hybrid approach, where we have some students in the classroom, some students simultaneously watching class online, and then for some students who might need to have access because they got sick or because whatever, we're going to have things available pre-recorded, or the lecture recordings will be available for them. None of us have done that before, so I think we're working on it real hard, and I've been working all summer since the last time I talked to you. I've been working on this. I hope it works. I really miss my students. They miss us, miss each other, and I hope it works great as we're all planning. Everything is different, but it sure isn't going to be the way it was. We're all going to be there in masks and trying to figure out how we have a conversation about psychology and other topics wearing a mask in class with some people online. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but I'm working on it.
Will all the fine folks around Mount Carmel, the students here, have they perfected? And I, admittedly, I worked for the school for 10 years, so I do this with all the love in my heart. Have they perfected Zoom connected keg parties yet? Have they worked on that yet? Is that still in the planning stage?
I hope not.
You're not going to comment on that. Okay.
Yeah, it's going to mess up all the plans.
Professor Carrie Bulger, a psychology professor at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. Professor, thank you. We'll be in touch. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Paul.
Task force, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was there. And they wanted to follow up from the president's executive orders that he announced a couple nights ago that created a little bit of confusion, I think. And they just said, look, we're just trying to get money out to people sooner, but we really want to reach a deal between the Senate and the House. And just to give you some insights that I think they want us to make public. Number one, from the White House's point of view, and probably the Republican Senate, education is first and foremost, over $100 billion. They really want to make sure that we do everything we can to get our schools back safely. And I think there's some general consensus between Republicans and Democrats there, if they can go forward. Obviously, a bit more of a dispute about state and local aid. They put on the table $150 billion. This is the Republican plan. The Democrats were looking for a lot more money, just given the nature of the revenue shortfall that the state has hit and towns like Milford have hit. And we'll see whether there's any more room for negotiation there. Other priorities from the White House, they said it would be child care, food, SNAP program, vaccinations, broadband. So those are all the items they have on the table to see if we can reach some sort of a compromise going forward. Not enough, but it's a starting point. But the main message they wanted to give us was, whatever you heard from the executive orders, more importantly, we're trying to reach a real deal. And finally, when it comes to unemployment compensation, there was some confusion there. It looks very good that the feds will give us at least a $300 a week true-up, maybe up to $400. The guidance is going to come out on that very soon, like in the next 24 hours. One of the things they heard from the governors is, look, the numbers are really important, but also the timing and the certainty, so we can count on what we need to do going forward. Enough on that if you have any other questions. Let's talk about the outage for 1 second. This is a kind of a complicated chart that comes out of Eversource, I think, in particular, the outages they have there. What you should know is, and here we are in day six, Eversource has got still 94,000 people without service, about 7% of their population. And UI, United Illuminating, has less than 1% of their people. So the good news is we've got 93% of the people back with power. It took 6 days, and obviously if you're without power now, you're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. This gives you an idea of some of the other towns that are still have more than 30% without power. Sharon, Sherman, Weston has been hit hard, Bethel, Woodbury, Ridgefield. Ridgefield, I've heard from a lot. Newtown, just there. Cornwall, Wilton, Reading, Harwinton. Probably the town that has the most number of outages still is Danbury. Obviously, they've gotten a lot done in the last 24 hours, a lot done which should have been done 3 days ago. But that's where we are right now. What can you do about this? Obviously, there's a lot of talk. Max, next slide. A lot of talk, fire the management and fines and rebates and refunds. And look, I think we'll take care of all that and see how things transpire. But I believe we heard all the same things after the last big outage back in 10 and 11. And we've had, I think we're on our fourth CEO of Eversource since then as well. So I've been talking to Katie Dykes about what we can do to deal with the systemic problems we have in terms of the reliability of our grid, and what we can do to make some real long-term changes that make sure our incentives are aligned when it goes forward. And one of the things Katie and I are looking at, and hopefully PURA, our regulatory body, is gonna be tasked as part of their docket, is to change the nature of the regulation. Right now, it's called rate of return regulation, which is sort of whatever you spend, we'll give you another 9% is rate of return on what you got, and we'll live to fight another day. And that makes no sense to me. That means we're giving you a rate of return on good things you do, bad things we do. And there's no incentives there for performance. So I am going to be really pushing hard to get performance-based of regulation, performance-based rate of return going forward. And in particular, when it comes to reliability and resilience. You know, it seems to me that if you do really well, you deserve a better rate of return. And if you don't perform, if you leave, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people without service for days on end, now we're coming up to a week, there should be penalties to pay. And one of the ways that we can influence that is through the rate of return analysis. So that's what Katie and I are going to focus on in a serious way to make sure our interests are aligned, that a utility has a real incentive to harden their system, a real incentive to make sure you have the remote status monitoring, a real insistence that you get the liaisons and you keep people fully informed every step of the way. And that said, you get rewarded when you do well and you get penalized when you don't do well. So we'll let all the other talk go on, but I think this is the type of performance-based rate of return regulation that makes all the sense in the world. No more bingo, whatever you did, here's 9% over and above it. That's not the way your world works. It's not the way my world has worked. It's not the way it's going to work right any longer when it comes to what we got to do with our utilities. Obviously, for me, reliability and resilience is number one, given where we've been for the last week. But affordability, ways that they can provide a better service at less cost, I'd like to see you know, some return for a utility for doing that. Customer satisfaction, that in terms of communication, telling people what's going on, how we can incent people to do a better job there. And finally, when it comes to the environment, when it comes to how we can make our grid more friendly in terms of you know, renewable energy sources. This is what Katie and Marissa, who runs PURA, looking at other states, looking around the country, seeing how we can be a lot more proactive when it comes to performance-based regulation. Let's see. With that, just to change course one more time, COVID. It has been a busy August. This is a three-day summary. I think it's the news is what you can see. We've done a lot of tests, 38,000 tests over the last 3 days. Fatalities, about one per day. Hospitalizations, pretty flat. Positive cases, 247. Again, good news. I think you'll find that's 0.6% of 1%. You know, so that is less than 1%. That's amazing. For the last week, it's 0.7%. So with all what you see going on, when you see Rhode Island has got 6%, when we've got thousands of contractors coming in from out of state to fix electrical outages, when you hear about these parties going on, thankfully, we're still at less than 1%, which is why if we can't get ourselves slowly back to work and back to school in a safe way, nobody will be able to do that. We're about tied with Vermont. Maine, damn it, is at 0.5%. So they got northern Maine. That gives them a bit of an advantage. But I'm proud of Connecticut. We're still doing very well on that front. Let's see. The next chart is we're not taking our eye off the ball. And we're going to continue to be strict because that's what's got us as far as we have and given us the good numbers we've gotten, allowing us to slowly get back to a new normal. And number one is we're going to be stepping up enforcement on those large private parties. And, you know, what that means is, look, you got 25 people inside, you got 100 people outside. You have the same rules as we do in, you know, for example, our stores. I want that mask on. I want to make sure you've got the distancing, and we're going to try and hold people accountable there. Fines and closures for businesses violating the rules. Again, it's we've been urging people. They've been doing a generally a very good job. We've got self-policing. We've got people calling in and going to our hotline, telling us about places that are a problem. You know, I was very interested to see that down in Bridgeport, there are a number of bars masquerading as restaurants, and they were having big parties in there. And Bridgeport, with local enforcement, stepped up and shut them down and took away their license. So this be a warning to people that we are taking this seriously, and local regulation and local enforcement is the best, and I salute what they did in Bridgeport. We have a lot of people who say, hey, I don't wear a mask in this store because I have a medical condition. Well, I think people are beginning to abuse that privilege. So from here on out, just bring your doctor's permission with you when you aren't wearing that mask and you're in that store, you're in that private area, because that's what the rules are. And finally, for the first time, we have just issued fines due to travel advisory violations. You know, people have been always saying, what are you going to do? What happens? And I said, look, I think overwhelmingly the number of people flying into our state from COVID-infected areas is way down. I think people are self-policing and self-regulating, but no, not all are. And we wanted to send a message loud and clear. So we have two folks who flew back to Connecticut, one from Louisiana, one from Florida. Neither of them filled out the form. They're paying a $1,000 fine. One of them didn't fill out the form and refused to quarantine. And we were noticed by a workmate of that person, and they're paying an additional $1,000 for violating the quarantine. Look, I hate to do it, but we're going to be serious, show people we're serious about this. And to date, it's made a difference, and I hope we can continue to make a difference. Overwhelmingly, people are doing the right thing. For those few of you who aren't, please be on notice. I think with that, well, I guess tomorrow is primary day. I'll just throw that in at this point. It's the primary day. I was asked by Secretary of State Denise Merrill to extend the period of time that your ballot can be mailed in. So it has to be postmarked by tomorrow, but it'll have another 48 hours to come in. Any way you can that you don't feel safe going to the ballot box, don't feel encumbered, and please mail it in. You've got another day to do that. Do that right. Do that safely. This is our dress rehearsal to get this primary done right. Overwhelmingly, you've told us people want to vote by mail. Some of the stumbling blocks they've had is just the sheer number of people that have done that, and that's why we're giving you an extra couple days. Especially given what's happened with this electrical storm, we need a little bit of extra time. You know, with that, Katie here on what we're doing in terms of regulation, what we're doing in terms of the outages, Josh, all-purpose hitter, and we've got the mayor of Milford here to tell you from the ground level up what he's seen going on. Over to you, Max.
NBC Connecticut.
Waiting on some questions here from the media for Governor Ned Lamont. Governor Test touching, rather, on some power issues and also on fines, he says, now that will be given out for folks who violate mask regulations and the social distancing regulations and the regulations set down as far as quarantines are concerned here in Connecticut. So once again, this is the Daily Briefing from Governor Ned Lamont. As he is now in the Q&A portion of it. He's with Deep Commissioner Katie Dykes as they wait to get the questions from the media. They're still doing this, of course, remotely as we bring it for you here right here on WICC 600. On Connecticut Today, we'll check traffic and weather together momentarily as we wait to see if any of the questions from the media are going to get through today to the governor.
We had more trees down. It was and still is a huge recovery. We're going to take days and weeks and months to get back to normal. We really do appreciate the resources that the state has brought down, but we were a little bit upset with some of the utility delay, the fact that the communication from our utility companies is not where it should be. The governor just mentioned that we, after each storm, have a lessons learned, and it seems like some of the same lessons that we learned after Storm Sandy, Storm Irene, continue on.
Obviously, we're improvising here. Anyone else have questions for Mayor Ben Blake of Milford, who's doing a fine job of standing up?
I'll throw in a question for the mayor. This is Suzanne from News 12.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Curious, you know, we have a lot of people, instead of commuting, we're working at home. It was sort of an improvised system. And then all of a sudden, we have the storm issues. Have you seen more people returning to their offices, or how have they been dealing with that situation?
Well, there's really two issues. One, obviously, everybody has power outage issues, either with UI or Eversource, depending what type of community you are. Milford's a UI community. The other issue is communications infrastructure. Altice has been terrible. Our optimum service has gone down tenfold, and people that were remote working, virtual working, I guess even the governor's office, they're having trouble communicating with some of the online resources that we have. So people are doing what they can to continue on with making sure that they're able to work. I do know that each individual employer is a little bit different in terms of what is allowable, but I do know that there have been communications issues.
Hey, thank you, Ben, and we are back. Good cameo, appreciate it. And we also have Jim Marpy's here. Hey, Jim.
Hey.
Go ahead.
First, like in Marpy, do you want to make any comments regarding what the situation has been like down in your neck of the woods over the past week?
Yeah, I was very pleased to be talking with or hearing Mayor Blake's report. Unfortunately, here in Westport, the story is a little worse, I'm afraid. We at our peak, we had 97% of our of Eversource's customers without power. I guess I'm pleased to say that we're down to 28% now. But frankly, I've got a lot of, as you might imagine, upset and angry residents who want to know when and how soon, and obviously that their power will be turned back on. My the challenge that we face here, frankly, in dealing with Eversource has been what I would describe as communication and coordination. The information that we've received is often not as good and up to date as we would like it to be, so that we can coordinate with the Eversource resources to make sure that we get the power back. By the way, I want to thank Governor Lamont and Lieutenant Governor Bisewitz for coming down on Friday to Westport and taking time to visit with us and explain what they're up to and what the state is up to. And I appreciate the help that the state has been giving to us. And I've been in regular touch, and my people have been in regular touch with the state as well. So thank you very much for that support. What I want to say is what Eversource, I think, needs to work on is how they collect their own information. My suspicion is they themselves are having trouble collecting information internally and then turning around and sharing that so we can share it as appropriate with our residents. That said, we've because of the heat today, we've opened a cooling station for our seniors. We're gradually getting back to kind of normal operations. But I think when this is all said and done, we need to sit down with Eversource and work very, very hard to figure out how to prevent this from happening again. Again, the struggle with me is I don't know if there are two crews in town, 20 crews, or 200. They're wherever they are, but we don't know where they are. And early on, we weren't getting the make safe crews that we needed in order to clear roads and keep people physically safe. Governor, I know you had the opportunity to visit one of our worst blockage areas, and thankfully, we have on retainer a retired Eversource coordinator technician to help us through this, but you saw how challenging that was, and we have areas all over town like that that we've cleared all the pathways so we can at least get to everyone, but it'll be a while before the cleanup takes place.
in New Haven. Professor, good to talk to you again. Thanks for hanging on. What do you make of all this? I think everybody agrees that the president has the authority to make these economic moves, but it's not the best thing. You don't generally want to sidestep Congress here. Is this just political theater here? And what do you think the economic implications are, especially if they make the states pick up, what is it, 25% of this extended unemployment? What do you think of this whole thing?
Well, I mean, the political game, I mean, that always goes on. What I think is more interesting is, it's an interesting set of policies that have been suggested. The extending the unemployment benefits, that's certainly going to help. I mean, the advantage of that is that's targeted to those who are suffering the most damages from the economy. The payroll tax cut, that will help a bit. But of course, some people are still doing pretty good, and so that's not quite as targeted. I think the states are being asked to pay for part of the additional unemployment benefits. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with it. But the federal government's still paying the bulk of it, but it does put the states in an interesting position, especially a lot of states aren't flush with money right now, so it's going to be tough on them.
In fact, the news, I guess, broke today that the state here in Connecticut, Professor, they're going to have to take out a loan here because the unemployment fund here, and this is not necessarily a surprise, that this was forecast a couple of weeks ago, that the unemployment fund here is almost completely tapped out.
Yeah, no, I mean, the unemployment rate, skyrocketed starting in March, and a lot of people have been collecting benefits, and it's been a real problem. So it's not like it would be nice if we had a nice rainy day fund where we could say here's the money that we set aside for that. But most governments, like a lot of households, aren't very good at that.
No, you're talking to somebody. No, I don't want to show you my credit card balances. Professor, give me your thoughts on people that say, and I'm guessing it's somewhere in the middle. Oh, my God, putting this payroll tax cut in, even if it's for a few months, is going to just hurt the Social Security Trust Fund. And other people say, relax, it's not going to be permanent. This is just a carrot to get us through here. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, if it's only for a few months, I don't think it's a huge problem. I think, Social Security does have problems years down the road, and it's a problem that needs to be addressed. But if we do this just for a few months, I don't think that's that big a deal. Now I've heard some proposals of getting rid of the payroll tax or permanently cutting the payroll tax. Then I think there'd be a real problem because we have a lot of Social Security liabilities, and it's a very popular program, and no politician wants to cut that. And so if you cut your revenue and keep the benefits the same, that's just a recipe for problems.
There is this ongoing debate, Professor, and the guest is Professor James Thorson. He chairs the economics department at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor, you've obviously heard the controversies. Well, federal unemployment's okay, but $600 a week, $2,400 a month is a disincentive for people to work. What do you make of that?
Well, I can, certainly if people are making more money not working than working, that's an incentive problem. There's no doubt about that. Now, the question is how much effect does that have? That's an open question, because the problem is that, if I have a long-term relationship with an employer, am I going to say, no, I'm not interested in coming back just to get a few hundred extra bucks for a short period of time? So how much of an effect that's going to have, for people that have, let's say a long-term relationship with an employer, that's probably not going to be as big of a deal. But for people who are marginally attached to the labor force, who, work at one job for a few months and go someplace else, that could have real incentive effects. So it's something to to worry about.
The latest employment numbers that came out last week were a little, I guess you could call them encouraging, maybe. I mean, the overall unemployment numbers are still way higher than they were. Is this thing, Professor, still somewhat of a house of cards here? Are we limping through this, and will we get through this if, God willing, there is no other major spike in the coronavirus? Are businesses, you think, just going to have to learn to maybe deal with this for about another year or so till we get that either a better level of therapeutics or a vaccine?
Well, I think that if, you know, we find ways to manage it, you know, so for example, you know, in Connecticut, we've been doing very, very well, and things have been opening up, and, you know, nowhere near where they were before, but things at least been moving in the right direction. You know, if we keep finding ways to manage it, then I think we will grow out of this. But if all of a sudden cases start to spike again, and then we have to do another, shutdown, then all bets are off, going to be off in the economy.
You know, finally, Professor, I read a couple of things over the weekend from not crazy people. I mean, some of these people, American economists and those overseas with very good credentials, great resumes, are saying, hey, if you really want to kill this COVID thing once and for all, or get it down to where it's practically nothing, shut everything down again and do that for what remains in August and then September and October. So they're saying, you know, an eight to 10 week shutdown as the cold weather comes. And that would do a great amount in the long term to get us back up and going. Is that even at all, in your mind, practical? Could we endure another shutdown like that?
Well, the problem that I would see with that is, okay, you know, that's a theory. Unfortunately, the problem we have is we don't really know enough about this virus to really say one thing one way or the other. But the problem we have is, you know, our government doesn't have a whole lot of money to basically support people for an 8-week shutdown, so that would put a lot of strain on the economy right there. If we knew it would work and we had resources to say, okay, people aren't going to work, but, you know, we're going to come in and we're going to help you out and we're going to take care of it, then, you know, maybe it would work. But you know, number one, it's speculative. And number two, we don't really have the resources to support that. So, you know, I'm not sure that that's our best option at this point.
Great stuff, as always. Professor James Thorson, thank you. He's the chair of the Economics Department at Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, thank you. Good luck, and we'll talk down the road. We appreciate
okay.
it. Thanks,
thank
Professor.
You.
Appreciate it. Thanks. Well, there you go, folks. Business reporter for Hearst Connecticut Media. He's been doing this for a lot of years here in the state. He's very good at what he does. He's an old college buddy of mine. I did the math the other day, and I met this gentleman, I think it was about 41 years ago. Luther Turmel joins us. You see his stuff in the Connecticut Post, in the Register in New Haven, in the various Hearst Connecticut papers around. Luther, my friend, how are you?
A lot better now that I've got my power back, but it's great to be on your show, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Luther, thanks for coming on. You cover these power companies, I know, on a regular basis. So I want to have you on, and we chatted last week about this, because I think a lot of these companies, Luther, and it's not just the power companies, it's the water company, the gas company, the cable company. These companies, Luther, come over as these big, sometimes unresponsive behemoths to people, not just here in Connecticut, but all over the country.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I mean, in some cases it's justified and in some cases it's not. I'll give you an example of that right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. Frontier. Now, again, let me preface all of this by saying that the people who are working to repair this, the lines people and, you know, the people who are out in the field are working as hard as they can. And unfortunately, I think they've been dealt a bad hand. Today, there have been countless people I've seen, including some neighbors of mine, who are complaining that they don't have Frontier Internet service. Now, you know, in the large scheme of things, yes, water is important, and yes, electricity is important. So I'm not trying to put internet service up there, but it's pretty close. And with everybody working from home, my next door neighbor waited 90 minutes on hold, and then was basically told that that the neighborhood had been fixed, that the internet problem had been fixed. Well, that was a big surprise to her. So. Mm.
Tell us, explain the Eversource structure. You know, to a lot of us that grew up in the state, Luther, it was always UI and CLNP or NU. Now the company, of course, known for a few years as Eversource. Explain the company structure here. Are they a parent company? Are they co-owned with any companies? What has the evolution of the Eversource name and been? And what's the structure of the ownership here for people that just may not know?
Well, Eversource was created when CLNP, or excuse me, Northeast Utilities, merged with NSTAR, which is based out of Boston. And I'm looking at a March 2012 story where, in order to get the state not to oppose the merger of the of those two companies, CLNP, the merger partners agreed to freeze distribution rates, the cost of what's involved of bringing electricity to your house for 2.5 years. And that was in March of 2012. And for those that don't know the Eversource structure, they say that they have twin headquarters, mm-hmm. one in Boston and one in Hartford. And I would argue that I wouldn't be surprised that the CEO spends 90% of his time in Boston. I mean, when a journalist calls, when the power goes out, you know, not of this magnitude, but you know, for a your run-of-the-mill everyday outage, the calls are all directed to Boston. And, you know, I understand that in this day and age that there's lots of mergers going on, but I would argue that you have a situation here where I don't know that the size of the service territory that Eversource has, a lot in Massachusetts, part of New Hampshire and a large chunk of Connecticut, you know, it's hard to sometimes priorities aren't directed toward Connecticut. Yeah. I will say that.
Okay. We're likely to see, Luther, and you and I talked about this the other day, there's going to be this big cha-cha of were you prepared, were you not prepared? Did you take this seriously? Did you not take this seriously? Yes, we did. The storm did some funky things. I would imagine, maybe you agree with me or not, that's going to be a big, you know, public wrestling match here. Maybe not right away, but at least in the coming months or when the General Assembly gets back together.
Well, it ought to be, quite frankly, because, and I would encourage people, particularly in your neck of Connecticut, to read a piece that my colleague, and I'm going to butcher her last name, Catherine Cresselt, or Cresselt, anyway. Forgive me, Catherine, if you're listening, but she did an excellent explainer on what happened over the weekend. I think you really need to, you know, things need to change. There was already, I mean, at the beginning of this year, there was a small groundswell of sentiment for bringing Connecticut back to, the deregulated generation at the beginning of the 2000s. And it really has been an abomination. I mean, there's some people that benefit from it, but for the average person, if you can't keep your eye on the electric rates all the time, it's not particularly beneficial. So I think that there's some sentiment in Hartford, you know, to do something. The problem is that, you know, with it being an election year, and particularly with the legislature, I'm already seeing people on both sides of the aisle that are, you know, making political hay with this. I'm not going to name any names, but I do think it's out there. And what really needs to happen is, you know, Eversource's and its predecessor CL&P's history is littered with, starting way back in 2011, I think it was Irene that was the storm back then.
Yeah.
Anyway, the power went out. This was at the end. This was in October, I believe, and it took them, I think it was almost 10 days to get the power back on. And the executive at the time, and again, I'm not going to mention his name because people can look it up and find it on their own. But he kept standing before the cameras with Governor Malloy and the United Illuminating people. And he was saying, well, we'll have everything taken care of by X date of X hour. And they kept missing it and kept missing it. And ultimately, it cost him his he went to another job, let's put it that way. But he was not. He sort of became a persona non grata.
He was traded for a player to be named later.
To be named later. Thank you for
Luther, hang on. We'll be right back with you. Well, Luther Turmel is the guest. We'll do another segment with him. He's a longtime reporter for the Hearst, Connecticut media properties, particularly the New Haven Register. But you see some of his things in the Connecticut Post as well. He covers the energy industry. God bless him. Because just in that 10 minutes he's been with us now, it's made my head spin. Luther, hang on. Traffic and weather together, 516 on WICC. And what is in the news is the response or perceived lack thereof from Eversource in particular in dealing with the tropical storm Isaias last week. We are now a week out, and there are still some folks not reconnected with power. Luther Turmel joins us, old college buddy of mine, but a great journalist of his own right, covering business for the Hearst, Connecticut papers, the Hearst, Connecticut Media Group, and in particular, the power companies. Luther, you know, you and I have dealt with corporate spokespeople over the years, a guy that we've talked to numerous times, you and I both, Mitch Gross. He's been on this station a few times. He was on the other morning saying, listen, we prepared, given the data that we had, you know, Connecticut's got a lot of trees. We keep telling people to thin the trees. What do you make of all that? Because I'm hearing from now pure people and deep people saying, no, wait a minute. You badly misread this storm. And, yeah, we've got a lot of trees, but that doesn't take you off the hook. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Mitch has a difficult job. I mean, I think that what's more important here is on Thursday afternoon and subsequent appearances this gentleman has made, Craig Hallstrom, he's the regional president of distribution for Eversource Energy. He held a press conference in Cheshire on Thursday about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he was the one that addressed the cameras. And he started out by saying that that Eversource has 100,000 customers in Cheshire. They have 11,000 customers. Now, I'll be generous. I'll cut him a break. I mean, he's coming in from Boston or wherever he's from. But then he went and started talking about how responsive they are to the, you know, to the various towns. And there's been countless examples, and not just in New Haven County, all the way over to the quiet corner. And, you know, but in Cheshire, there were no stoplights that were working, even as he was speaking. Route 10 goes right through Cheshire.
Yeah, yeah.
But for the grace of God, there, you know, people did what they were supposed to and came to a full stop at the stoplight. But to stand there and to say that they're responsive to the town just isn't true. And a day later, Sean Kimball, who's the town manager of Cheshire, basically said that their numbers, you know, they were being, you know, they were having difficulty getting any responses from Eversource.
Yeah, that
so,
Luther, that,
you know, I'm not.
Yeah, that seems to be what a lot of these people are saying, Luther, is, listen, we understand this was bad, but they're really recoiling at the communication or lack thereof. That's what we heard today. In particular, Jim Marpy, who was with the governor today, the Westport First Selectman, he's like, I didn't really know what was going on in my town.
That's true. And Fairfield had the same problem. I mean, Fairfield, the folks in Fairfield resorted to going on the social media bully pulpit and tweeting about how unresponsive, they were having a problem in Fairfield with UI because that's UI's service territory. And look, you know, it's a difficult situation all around, but I do think it's very instructive that, you know, Cheshire's right next to Wallingford, and within a couple hours after the storm had left, my wife and I took a drive over to Wallingford, and Route 5, everything was open.
Everything was open.
Now, yeah, and just so people understand, Wallingford is a municipally owned electric utility, and, you know, they may very well have a few people that are still without power there, but, you know, a lot of people from northern New Haven County were going into Wallingford to do their shopping and get their food because, you know, it just boggles my mind in some cases.
It's going to be wild. Luther, final question, and about the minute we have left, you know this is going to happen, but quickly, I'm looking at a release from a state rep, a Fairfield County state rep, who's going to be on the show tomorrow, and you know this is going to happen, but he is called now for an investigation and to look into whether or not Eversource should be broken up here in Connecticut. Is that even possible, or is this just, you know, another reaction here?
It's a knee-jerk reaction. It's not going to happen. I mean, you'd have to get a real groundswell, and they've got deep pockets. And, you know, one of the things people always talk about is municipalize more of the state's electric, you know, create other Wallingfords, so to speak. And, you know, there's a whole process that's involved in that, you know, about how much the towns would have to pay for the assets that they were getting from, you know, the distribution network from Eversource. And, you know, I would be very surprised if that could happen. Now, I've been wrong before, and I'll probably be wrong again. But I'd say I wouldn't expect that to happen.
Luther, it's been great. Now, listen, I hope this doesn't happen again, but you and Joan, I've been instructed by Mayor Bill Dickinson to tell you that you and Joan and your boys, when you're home, well, come on over to Wallingford. The water's fine. If this ever happens, you can have dinner on Route 5 all the time. Okay.
Well, that's decent of him because we do it anyway.
So. Just mention my name around town. They'll go, who? Luther Turmel has been the guest. Old college buddy of mine. Works, though, for Hearst Connecticut Media. Covers, as you heard, rather deeply. It's not the most exciting thing to cover, but he knows the energy business in Connecticut. Luther, thank you. We appreciate the time. We'll be in touch.
Okay. Take care, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye.